I love days like these at the pool, but my moderate to severe plaque psoriasis can sometimes take me out of the moment. I'm ready to make a splash with clearer skin thanks to SKYRIZI, risankizumab riza. SKYRIZI is a prescription-only injection for adults who are candidates for systemic or phototherapy. At 4 months, most people saw 90% clearer skin when measured from head to toe, and many were even 100% plaque-free. People also saw significant improvement in psoriasis symptoms of pain, redness, itching, and burning.
Don't use if allergic to SKYRIZI. Serious allergic reactions, increased infections, or lower ability to fight them may occur. Before treatment, get checked for infections and tuberculosis. Tell your doctor about any flu-like symptoms or vaccines.
Now there's nothing on my skin, thanks to SKYRIZI, and that means everything. Ask your doctor about SKYRIZI, the number one dermatologist-prescribed biologic in psoriasis. Visit SKYRIZI.com or call 1-866-SKYRIZI to learn more.
Astonishing Legends Network.
The views and opinions expressed by hosts and listeners on the Astonishing Dead Letter Office are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of Astonishing Legends Productions, the Astonishing Legends Network, or any affiliated entities or guests.
When something unexplainable happens to you, it can make you feel isolated or alone. But trust us, you're not. For over a decade, you've been sending your strange stories to Astonishing Legends. And now it's time for our fellow Legenders to hear them too. Join us weekly in Blanket Fortiana as we dig through your intriguing messages to the Astonishing Dead Letter Office.
Tonight's episode, The House on 109.
Well, this next story that comes to us is a bit of a, I guess Scott would call it a quiet story.
Yes, yes.
Is that because nothing dramatically major happens or?
Well, it's just an ongoing milieu of things equally interesting. And I can see how they could have been actually life-changing for our friend who sent the story in. But, you know, it's not... You know, the poltergeist where you open the door and things are spinning in the room.
When it's that level, then you have a problem.
Yeah.
It's time to call someone. Who are you going to call? My point is that, you know, the house I grew up in, small things have happened throughout the years, but just a handful that were just slightly odd. The story we're about to tell, even though you might consider it a quiet story in that, there's no maybe a huge swirling room of... the children's toys and clapping monkeys and this and that, there's enough there where this is a lot more than what went on at my house or yours.
Yes, that's true.
There's definitely something going on there that is out of the ordinary. And the story comes from a good friend of ours.
Yes.
Who we've known for years now, actually, Jonathan Ady. We had drinks. We chatted a bit at Monster Fest and maybe shared some food and drinks, but we didn't get to talk enough because apparently there's a story he wanted to tell us. But, you know, there's a lot of people coming up and we wanted to divide our time evenly between everybody. But so he's been sitting on this one for a bit. And the story is about the experiences that he had as a kid. Let's just say it's an unusual house. That's my point is like there's levels of how unusual things get. Mine are always, you could usually explain them away as a, you know, okay, that's very strange, but maybe it was this. In this case, I think it's one of those things where it can't be anything other than something supernatural.
Well, we're headed to North Central West Virginia for this story, Taylor County, a small town called Grafton. It's one of those towns that punches above its weight historically. Most folks don't know this, but Grafton is basically a child of the railroad. The Baltimore and Ohio came through there in 1852. And the town more or less coalesced around that junction point. The name itself supposedly comes from Grafton On, where the branch line met the main line. But almost overnight in the 1850s, it becomes a major freight and passenger hub between Baltimore and the Ohio River Valley. And for us, funnily enough, The Baltimore and Ohio is the first railroad I ever really knew because when I was a kid, my one and only model train was a B&O, like HO scale. Uh-huh. Kind of hits me in the chest to be talking about it tonight.
So. Well, the B&O, talking about that. Also, it's like so many towns here in the United States in the early to mid 19th century, where the railroad dictated the growth of a town.
That's right.
And it boomed if it was coming through there and it was a major point of commerce, or they dried up if that went away and the line got diverted. I mean, think about St. Joseph, Missouri. We often talk about that.
Yeah.
Because I don't think people nowadays, unless you've studied your regional history there, how important that hub was.
That's right. That's right.
And so storied. And so I got a little picture of a railroad town in the 1850s or so. Yeah. And, to the 1900s. And those memories and energies don't seem to fade.
Yeah, that's true. By the way, you know, speaking of St. Joe, my son and I watched Paper Moon the other night, and a good portion of it takes place in St. Joe, so which I had forgotten. You know, you and I have been there, and we talk about it a lot, but that was pretty wild to see it. It's such a beautiful movie, by the way, folks. If you've ever never seen Paper Moon, it's amazing.
Oh, classic. Yeah. Well, also cinema history, the youngest Oscar winner ever, Tatum O'Neill,
that's right.
Won for that role.
Yep.
And there is something, though, to these towns. And I think when Scott and I rolled in, coming from Atchison, we didn't know what to expect, really. I was just excited.
Yeah.
But I would not say that I had my mind stuffed with images of ghosts and this and that. But when we rolled through St. Joe, as it's affectionately known, there's a vibe.
Yeah, it does. It has a feeling. It does have a feeling.
Right. And in this case here, your imagination might be all you need.
That's right.
Now, I was going to ask you, though, your case here, you know, being raised by a single mom, what was your experience like? Because what I was asking you before we got on mic is that there were some stories you had told me and I might have conflated some, but was there anything odd or what was the scenario like growing up like that, and if anything strange happened in any houses?
Well, nothing paranormal. We were pretty broke. We did have some brushes with scary people trying to break in the house and things like that. But they were very solid and real and alive. Right. So got saved by my black lab in that case. But
well, as we often say, the real monsters are human and alive.
Yeah. So, but here's the other thing. When I talked to you about that model train I had a little bit ago, the place that I had that train as a kid, it was just like an oval on a piece of 4x8.
Yeah,
like I said, my mom didn't have any money, but that was in the house that I took you that we tried to find in Denver when we went to Podcast Movement in 2023.
That's
and I was making you drive all around town with me looking for where that house used to be. I knew it had been torn down, but I just wanted to get to where it was because it was a prominent memory for me as a kid.
No, that was very cool. Yeah. And if you remember, I think one of the neighbors there, we bought some backyard cultivated honey.
Well, that was a different house. That was another house.
Yes.
This one, right. I'm talking about the one that where we went and walked around on the empty lot. Yes.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
It's so strange to come back years later and see things change.
Yeah.
You know, the house you grew up in, it's leveled.
Yeah.
It's now an Arby's.
Well, this one, yeah. This would that
this
and
one
this
still
is how,
had the Arby's.
Yeah, the house behind the Arby's. That's how I called it. My mom and I called it that our whole lives. Although I looked it up today. This is just since 23. There was still an Arby's there. That's not an Arby's anymore. It's now a Taco Star, which I'm sure is delicious in its own right. But my mom had rented that house on the empty lot behind the what's now the Taco Star. And that's I had my train there. But anyway, the real B&O, the one running through Grafton, West Virginia, that saw everything. Coal moving east, timber moving east, soldiers moving in both directions. Both of West Virginia's national cemeteries are right there, which you'll hear Jonathan talk about tonight. Grafton was a major Union supply depot during the Civil War. So there was a general military hospital on Walnut Street with thousands of wounded coming through there. And the first Union soldier killed in the war was reportedly shot near there in May of 1861. Then weirdly, in 1908, the same little town became the birthplace of Mother's Day, which, by the way, just passed as we're putting this episode out.
Yeah.
And decades after that, on a country road outside of town, the Grafton Monster shows up in 1964. So there's a lot going on here in this little spot that you might not have heard of these days. A railroad junction, a war hospital, a national shrine to motherhood, and a cryptid.
Yeah, well, that might be a future episode here.
Yeah.
I love monster stories
when
I was growing up. And I was going to say, there's definitely a vibe when things that are very old, at least for the America here, North yes. America and the United States. There's a feeling when things change so much and
yes.
you realize how ephemeral it was and is from when you grew up. But it's also, there's a feeling and a vibe when things don't change.
That's
like
right.
Like I said, you have so much of this history here.
Yes.
And it's just it just permeated. And that feeling or that historical residue or energy there, you can sense. And that's what I was talking about with St. Joseph. It's still, yeah, it's a modern town now. And it's,
yeah.
it's struggling a bit, but the houses are still there.
Yeah.
And there's definitely a feel to it.
Yeah.
Because some things have not changed.
That's right.
But our friend Jonathan, you know, he's carried the story around for a long time before he sent this in, as I was saying, and he—that's one he wanted to tell us in person, but ran out of time.
Yes.
So we never quite got the chance. But tonight he gets his chance. So, Scott, please take it from the top.
Hello, Scott and Forrest. This is Jonathan Adie. I met you both at Monster Fest, and I've been wanting to share this story with you for a long time. Scott, I remember wanting to talk to you the night after the festival was over, but you guys were both super busy with people that had come to see you there. With that said, I figured this could be a good place to share this story. I call this the House on 109, and if I'm being honest, this was going to be the first episode of a podcast I've wanted to start but just never got around to. I grew up in a little town in West Virginia called Grafton. To this day, I don't believe the population is much more than 5,000 people, but it sure does have its history. It has two national cemeteries, is home to the official Memorial Day Parade of West Virginia, and is home to Mother's Day and the Mother's Day Shrine. While the railroad still runs through there today, it was once a hub and a center point between Ohio and Baltimore on the line. My dad moved my sister and I there when we were young after my parents divorced, and he took on a preaching role in the town at the local Church of Christ. He had met my now stepmother at the church, who was also divorced, and they decided to get married. Before they did, though, they would not live together, so she was in a house across town, 109 East Washington Street. When they eventually married, we moved into that house, which had been in her family, and to say it was a strange place is an understatement. But the strange started before we moved in. The first incident I can recall was a night where she had called my dad in the middle of the night and asked him if he could come over because she had awakened to a man standing at the foot of her bed and thought someone had broken in. We didn't know it at the time, but this was just the beginning of what was to come. After we moved in, I never felt truly settled or at home in this house. Most would have chalked that up to not living with my mom anymore and being in a new town, etc., but this place was just off. These are just some highlights. There was a room we called the cold room because the temperature, no matter what time of year, would suddenly drop at a moment's notice and would require a blanket to cover up in while playing video games. Sometimes you could see your breath. My stepbrother and I shared a room at the top of the steps, and there were many nights we would wake up to the sound of footsteps going up and down. There was a little girl I saw more than once playing in the house with a ball before just vanishing through another door at the end of the hall. Lights would turn on and off, as well as the radio, and my dog, who was a lap dog, would walk slowly down the hall almost as if he was tiptoeing and then start backing up and growling with his hair raised, only to run back into the living room to get back on my dad's lap. Sometimes the basement door would slam, and don't even get me started on the basement itself. It was terrifying. Dirt floors and dirt walls and half the steps leading down to the bottom were missing. I once even found a set of skeleton keys while digging down there. One of the house highlights was that it was only one of three homes at one point on Washington Street, and George Washington had stayed in one of them, so the chances were pretty good. My sister, my stepmother, both stepbrothers, and my cousin all had encounters there. In fact, my cousin, who lived in it for years as an adult, had come home from Iraq after serving and tells the story that the moment the activity began, he just yelled throughout the house, "Enough!" He had been through war, shot at people, and been shot at, and that now was not the time, and it quieted down. There's so much more to this story, but as a fan of the Dead Letters, I know there's not enough time to tell them all. Do yourselves a favor and look at the house on Google Earth, 109 East Washington Street, Grafton, West Virginia, and I feel you'll feel all the weird vibes just from seeing it.
The unexplained awaits. We'll return to the shadows momentarily. Now, back to the show.
Well, there you go. That's what I was talking about a lot of small, odd things happening, but the gestalt of it, the cumulative effect is that there's something wrong with this house. And so,
yeah.
That's what I'm saying is that taken individually, it's like, oh, there's a cold room, but everything's consistent. Like, it's consistently cold.
That's right.
In that room. Right. There's consistently footsteps heard when no one's there. The dog reacts. The doors close. There's so many small things that added up together.
Little girl with the ball.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Come on. That's if you and I saw that, we'd be freaking out. It's like that's like I said. If you saw that, it's undeniable. And
it's very Kubrick.
Yeah. Oh well. There's twin girls. Yes.
Yes.
So the idea though is that taken all together and over a lifetime here, and also the stepmothers seeing the guy over the bed.
Yeah.
I'm already leaning towards haunted house.
Well, and I want to get out in front of one thing. I just want everyone to know, and I talked extensively with Jonathan about this, that we fully have permission to share this address.
So yes.
The house, I believe it's family that still actually owns it.
Right.
And they signed off on it too. They're going to be listening to this episode when it comes out. So
yes, that's important to note. And I would take Jonathan up on his urging to go look at that house because that really fills in the story. So we just looked at it here. You'd looked at it previously.
Yeah, online, that is. We're not saying everyone needs to get in a car, but...
Certainly never go bother people unless you have a good reason, perhaps. But here, if you look at the house from just from street view, mm-hmm. it's a lovely little old house. And... you never know what goes on inside these old places, but I often do this. I don't know about you, Scott, but driving by, especially, I've been with, Jill and Roger driving by, some of these locations to these famous haunted places in the Midwest, and you just see regular houses. And I get this feeling like haunted, not haunted, not haunted, haunted, minor activity,
right.
Major
right.
activity there. You know, you just played a game of like, driving in the car, but you do get a sense quickly. I've been trying to attune that. And, you know, there's activity in probably most every house. Why not? There's spirits are everywhere if you believe in that.
Yeah.
So here, looking at it, though, it's like, yeah, I could see that. But it's not totally creepy is my point. It's a lovely little house, of course, showing its age a bit, but well-maintained. The yard looks nice. And if you go down the street with street view, the one, though, on the corner, and it's got, the, I think, a faux brick exterior.
Yes. At least in the street view picture. Maybe it looks different now. But
right.
Yes,
just speculatively, that one's got more of a haunted house vibe to it. But I don't know.
Right.
Like I said, you're just guessing. But like that has a little bit spookier appearance. But all in all, the neighborhood looks nice. It's older, obviously, but well-kept and a lovely little town. I had heard of Grafton before, but I'm not sure in this West Virginia context. I'm sure there's other towns called Grafton as well. And as Craig T. Nelson says in Poltergeist, what could be wrong on a day like this? The point being is you never really know what's going on, even though it seems sunny. So, yeah, getting back to the story here, you had done a little bit of digging on the history.
Yeah.
So we have a timeline of things that happened here to refer to. But talking about the historical nature of that area, it's very old, right, according to American standards.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And I wanted to look up about, you know, the George Washington part of it, because Jonathan and I, we actually had a phone call. I don't usually get to call people about this, but, you know, he and I text a couple times a year anyway. And I had asked him, you know, I said, hey, we're finally recording this. And so we talked a little bit about it. And he did say, well, you know, the rumor was that George Washington stayed in one of the houses on our street. I think he said one of three, and they had reason to believe it might have been this one. But one of the things that we found in our research, which I thought was interesting, is that the land where Grafton was built was originally apparently a 1,300-acre tract that settler James Current acquired in trade for a horse. And Current, at that time, hired 19-year-old George Washington as his surveyor.
Wow.
And this was in the 1750s. And Washington genuinely surveyed the ground Grafton now sits on.
Yeah.
So it's hard to know if he spent the night in one of these houses, but it's like a verified hard claim of Washington's presence in town, which is super cool. That's very, very cool.
Well, you got to figure, you ever done this? You've been on a road trip and you stay like in a small motel or hotel. You're way out in the sticks in the middle of nowhere, you think. And then you might be down having a breakfast in the nook there.
Yes.
And a bunch of crew guys come in and you're like, what are they doing? And it's like, well, they're working on the power transmission lines or phone or this and that, or they're doing surveying or land kind of management. And you have to realize, like, well, they don't live here in this little town. They're from a bigger area, but they have to do work here. So they have to stay somewhere.
Right.
And so you can't drive 200 miles back home after work every day. So they come and stay at the local motel. And I'm figuring it's possible George Washington, while surveying there, not being his home, maybe he did stay at that house. So I'm figuring George Washington may have slept there, as those signs, you know, like with historical buildings and that. He may have had a short residency there in the area and maybe even in that neighborhood. Because those houses on the street or in that tract there are some of the first houses in the area, right?
From what I can tell, it seems like that house might have been around 1900. I'm actually not sure about that. But if that was the case, the other thing to remember is that the Grafton National Cemetery has over 1,200 Civil War dead. So there's a high collection of war-related deaths there. And there was a lot going on even 40 years before this particular structure might have been built in the area. So I would definitely call it haunted territory. The other thing I thought was really wild was the that we mentioned in the cold open was in 1964, the Grafton Monster. This, I guess the paper reported a reporter named Robert Cockrell encountered a roughly 9-foot headless, smooth-skinned humanoid along Riverside Drive by the Tigert Valley River in June of 64. Search parties and armed teenagers went out and looked for it, but it's since then been embraced by the town. I guess there's a Grafton Monster Festival, a museum.
That's where I may have heard it, yeah.
Yes, and a cameo in Fallout 76. So that's pretty cool.
It's nice to be remembered, isn't it?
Yes,
and
it is.
You're
especially when you're
monster.
A headless monster. You know,
that's fascinating. I love the different aspects of, just the details of something like that where, of course, a 9-foot, 10-foot tall humanoid, smooth skin kind of thing is weird, but then it's headless. You know, it's like there's an extra twist to the story. And here, that's kind of nothing new. I think, was it Marco Polo? There was some explorer. One, he reported coming across dogmen. They spoke.
Oh, that's right. That's
right. But in guttural kind of thing, it's just like, okay, we're going to believe everything else Marco Polo said. But that's a little nuts. So just strange things pop up. But one is the legend of men that had no head popping out, but they had kind of a face in their chest that they saw and spoke from.
That's right. You've mentioned that before. And I'm always like, what is that? Of course, you always wonder, okay, was this an elaborate costume or dress of some kind?
Right. It's hard to pull
that
off.
They just weren't used to seeing.
The headless Halloween gag that your son did. Your head falls into your hands with the Halloween costume gag. But in this case, there's a lot of death and injury and pain and suffering and everything a town goes through. But a little bit more with Grafton here. Maybe it is one of those vortex places where the veil is a little bit thinner than other places.
Yeah.
And people have congregated that. It's a little bit of history. But as we know, also, a house doesn't have to be really old to be haunted or have a lot of activity. There has to be other factors there. So, like the bedside man appearing, that was before the family moved in. The stepmother saw that. That's what called Jonathan's father over in the middle of the night to contend with. And so, I would guess that there's always been activity in that house. And then you have a lot of human live activity, which seems to be a catalyst and kick up the supernatural activity.
Because
why not? They're thriving. When no one's there, it's empty. It's like you're just kind of wandering around waiting for the party to start. And then, now there's young people here and they're playing these weird electronic games in the magic glass box, the lantern box. And it's so much fun. And so, you're obviously kicking up a lot of activity here and a lot of different witnesses to this one too. Like the little girl with the ball, she was seen on more than one occasion by other folks and also vanishing through a door.
Yeah.
Like I said, that's the one that's kind of undeniable. You can explain away footfalls and other strange things, even like the door slamming. It's the wind. Well, there's a window open, the wind blew it closed and
Another one of these, and we've come across this before. It's the whole chicken and the egg thing that I did want to mention about this, because there is a famous late folklorist named Ruth Ann Music, M-U-S-I-C-K. Mm.
Yeah.
And she has a famous book called The Telltale Lilac Bush. And apparently this was required reading in a lot of West Virginia fifth grade classrooms.
Oh.
And it establishes a regional convention of these types of hauntings, especially involving children's apparitions and benevolent or stuck spirits.
Yeah.
And that it's just part of Mountain State storytelling, which of course you can imagine is connected to Appalachian folklore and all of these things are intertwined. Yeah, so, exactly. Yeah. There's all that stuff. So of course I wanted to ask Jonathan, I was like, hey, maybe you were young. This book influenced you. I texted him yesterday and I said, hey, without looking it up, have you heard of this book?
Yeah.
And he goes, yeah. I know that book. And I said, it's listed as a common childhood influence for kids from that area. Do you feel like it might've influenced your perception of things going on in the house? And he came back and said, I read that book way after this all happened. He said, that house changed my life forever.
Wow,
he goes, it's the reason I became interested in the strange. The things I experienced there will live with me forever.
Right.
So this is a case which I thought was interesting because then you have the folklore and Ruth Ann Music capturing this and publishing this book that becomes part of the local cultural zeitgeist as it relates to ghosts and everything. And the question has to be, do real events, is there a reason the folklore exists? Is it because, this is happening? Because it certainly seems like it's happening in the house on 109 on East Washington. So I thought that was really interesting. It was like, I know that book, but I didn't read it until much later because he legit, and that's part of the reason we saw him at Monster Fest. Like a lot of people that reach out to us and a lot of you listeners that are sending us stories in the Dead Letter Office, the reason you found our show in the first place is because something happened to you at some point in your life. And for a lot of folks, it's not just that something happened. It's like, oh, I'm going to spend the rest of my life trying to figure out if this was real, am I crazy, or has this happened to other people? How much I want to study this and understand it better, which I think is part of the reason that Jonathan came over to the Astonishing Legends fold, as did a lot of you listeners. So I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, it's like any other human endeavor, I would suppose. You get influenced by your own experiences. It's like my my orthopedic surgeon one time said, well, how'd you get into orthopedic surgery? He's like, well, because I was in medical school, didn't know what to take. And then I was on a skiing trip, broke both my ankles.
Right.
And they might have been compound fracture. He said, that got me interested. Like, that's because I'm going to fix myself. And so you kind of want to fix yourself with this. It's like, I need to know what's going on here. I want to get some answers or at least understand it better. And it leads to an interest. And then other folks, it's like, I don't want to know anything about this. This didn't happen. I don't care what you show me. I'm going to continue to deny it because I can't handle this. I don't want to handle this. I don't have time. And so that's one way to react.
Yeah. And speaking of that, that's a good segue into something I wanted to touch on that I thought was really interesting too. And that was with his cousin, the combat veteran who had been in Iraq and had like just a whole different assessment of threats and also what it takes to stop them and just yelling enough and then things calm down. Just like, and that pushback thing, that's something that we've talked about before. Not today, not now. That story you tell about the person was just like, please, I'm hungover or whatever. Go away
for
now.
There's a couple of those.
It's weird. There's a lot of stories where that seems to have an effect, whether it's a commanding, firm, stop, you know, or you go to the exorcism rites and it's like, you will leave this house or, you know, or whatever else. It's weird that that stuff seems to work. I don't know what that implies, if you believe any of this at all. I don't know what that implies about what you're interacting with and why does it seem like, you know, is this bad? I'm out. Sorry. Yeah. I'll come back later, you know, kind of thing. That's interesting.
Yeah, you're right. And a couple of thoughts on this. One, this is one of the most pervasive concepts that we've come across and everyone has who studies this. And it seems obvious at this point, but there is definitely, in my view, and my belief is that there is an interaction here which requires your permission and participation. And that a lot of this is people that, look, this stuff happens to people who didn't ask for it, obviously. You know, they didn't know anything about this. They don't care about this genre. And yet they saw something. But there is an exchange of energies and a bit of consciousness, if you will. And that requires, when you let something in, and that permission can be kind of tacit or declarative, and you say, okay, show me what you got. Same thing with the UFO experience. So many people say, like, I went outside and I tried to do some of the E-SETI protocols and I said, show me something. Show me that you exist. Put on a show for me. I welcome you to this. And then something will happen with orbs in the sky dancing
around.
You are welcoming this in.
A lot of people, that summoning stuff, it's like I've read, obviously, because of what we do, a lot of people, the summoning is particularly with UAP. And I just am not sure. Every now and then I'll go outside and walk the dog, but it's very half-hearted. I'll be like, if you're up there, you can go ahead. You know what? Don't worry about it.
Because
I'm just like, having crossed paths with things, I'm not convinced I want it to come.
Right.
Like, it's let it go to the other people. They can take a picture, send it to me, and I'll take a look at it. Because I am very much in the be careful what you wish for camp when you're doing an investigation into UAP, NHI, or the paranormal, other kinds of, you know, ghosts and that sort of thing.
Yeah, that's my point.
It's a little bit like once you get past the, oh, I have to prove this is real. Right. And, you know, it's like, I can't remember, there's a podcaster who says, ghost hunting is fun until the ghosts show up kind of thing.
Yeah, so well, that's right. Yeah. No, I mean, there's levels to that. You want to see some activity, then people go too far, especially with things with certain haunted houses where they try to use spells and potions and whatnot to trap spirits in so they can get more evidence. And you're playing with fire in a sense, because I do believe in the spooky action at a distance and entanglement in the quantum level where that stuff follows you home and you've allowed it to. And the thing with the UAP, and like I said, there is that overall connection to everything, I believe, in some fashion, even if it's many steps down from the initial interaction, but you are welcoming this and inviting it. And then it happens and it's like, okay, you and I, Scott, know that could be troublesome because of what's happened to other folks that have had this experience. It's not great. You're not going to get superpowers. Some people claim to have been more psychic in a way, prescient. You have certain abilities opened up perhaps, but you're not going to become part of the Marvel comic universe. So
Right. Well, in the case of like, you know, skinwalkers at the Pentagon, what you're going to have, like when you call an orb and it passes through your body, is like chronic pain in your shoulder for the rest of your life where it went through you or whatever.
Now, there's another theory that ties in with this that I've heard, I've discussed with Roger Pinkleton as well, because we talk about like that's the old trope, right? The cold room, even in The Sixth Sense, you can see your breath. It's so cold suddenly. Very well done in that movie to illustrate that the condensation on the doorknob, the breath coming out of your mouth, and that may be attributed to an opening up of some kind of portal or passage between dimensions or realms, where there's also a burst of gamma radiation. There's something that affects temperature for one, and the other one that there's actually an energetic burst that affects you, maybe not intentionally by the other entities or whatever, but it comes with the experience. And that you get a dose of something or something passes through your body and now you have health effects that are often like radiation effects. I mean, look at Travis Taylor on the Skinwalker Ranch, and he got dosed, opening up, you know, that concrete slab that had some very stagnant water in it, and that's reading really high. He gets dosed. They come back later, nothing. No Geiger counter is reading anything. It's transient.
Right.
So that's very strange. Yeah. So this thing's floating around and maybe has some consciousness to it perhaps. But the other thing I was going to talk about as far as this exchange of permission and interaction where you choose to interact with it, you can also try your best to deny it. And so people have written to us over the years. It's like, how do I get this to stop? And we always say, because this is what others have told us. It's like, one, if you really want this to stop, you have to really want this to stop. Because it's about intention as well. And then a lot of times people will say like, well, this is still going on. You know, what do I do? You know, I'd say, did you talk to somebody? Did you actually take the steps they recommended? And they're like, well, not really. I don't know if I believe in that stuff. Well, you don't believe in that stuff, but you believe that something's happening. That's that's supernaturally weird. And then there's also a weird thing. I think it's the fellows from West Virginia Paranormal investigative team. I think they were telling us. There's that one case we did cover where we mentioned it, that they were on. And they had mentioned either directly to us or in our posts years ago how they were investigating this woman's house and had a ton of activity. And they were doing everything they could as far as procedures and ceremonies and this and that to get rid of it. And she then called them back after a couple of weeks. It's like, yeah, it's back, all this activity. Like, okay, we'll come by again, you know, on the courtesy of their own free time. And they get there and they notice that she still had the Ouija board under the couch.
Right.
I was like, hey, we told you to get rid of this. Like, well, yeah, but you know, it's really interesting. And I really like, she's lonely.
Yeah,
that's the thing. And that's also why she's having them come over so much, is that she wants the company and the interaction, even though it's scaring her and this and that. She's not willing to take the steps to say, that's enough. Like the cousin did in our story here. So the other thing I was going to mention is that combat veterans, senses may be very heightened. I think that's generally the case with anybody that's been under fire in combat situations where it's very stressful. Your senses get heightened, and unfortunately, that leads to PTSD a lot of the time, or is part of it.
Sure.
But I talk about my own cousin, my cousin's husband, who was formerly a EOD specialist, an EOD specialist, which is an explosive ordnance disposal expert. And basically, yeah, he's the hurt locker guy for the Navy.
Right.
So he went through BUDS and all that, basic underwater demolition / SEALs. And I asked him after, you know, he came back, do you notice anything changing with your behavior here that you're back in the States? And, you know, I wasn't asking about PTSD because, oh yeah, he said, one thing you notice is that I'll be just be driving around like on the freeway and we go under an underpass and I'm looking for the corners and the spots where an IED, an improvised explosive device, would most likely be hiden. Yeah, he says, yeah, you're hiding. It's just like, okay, that would be a great place to hide a bomb. And as you said here, you know, the nervous system, it's been calibrated to that threshold level. And so you make that demand. And often we hear that too, is that whatever's causing this will heed that a bit. Like, oh, I guess he's upset. Sorry, we were just kind of having a little fun here. But you have some control in this. And when people ask us what they can do, I always try to emphasize that fact, is that you are a part of this player here. You don't have to be the passive victim. You have some control over this if you want, and you have to state your intention, and you have to believe it most of all. It's just like the priest and the vampire Kurt Barlow in Salem's Lot. He's a priest, but he had lost his faith, and then it's useless. Yeah, and this, though, I like that fact. It's like, okay, stop it. That's enough. Give me some peace and quiet here. And it seemed to work. It doesn't get rid of it completely, but I think you can quiet it down. Much like noisy neighbors like the ones I had. I would bang on the ceiling repeatedly, and it would quiet down. And then the next couple of nights around the weekend, it would start back up again.
And here's another thing I wonder. Like, I wonder if the overall package of this in terms of the home is just its own thing. Like, if it takes on, it becomes almost a kind of organism in a way. It's like, it's the little girl, it's the doors. It's a combination of events that really are just different glimpses of one larger thing that's all interconnected for whatever reason. Because the other thing about this is it feels very much like echoes from the past, maybe a little less interactive in some
That's
cases
right. yeah.
and more, you know, like this is me, I'm your house, this is what I do.
Totally down with that. No, I agree. And it made me think of the alien creature in The Thing, where it's a conglomeration. That's really one organism, but is it tied in? Is there a bunch of different organisms there? And it can split off, it can morph into whatever, it can mimic. It has all these capabilities, but it's kind of collectively one species or one organism, but maybe made up of different things. Much like you said in the sludge entity case, several entities bound together by a more powerful one or some binding agent that's keeping these all separate points of energy and consciousness bound together, acting as one kind of thing throughout this house in this one location. So I like that concept.
Right.
But those skeleton keys, I wish could find what that would fit to, because, you know, that's another part of the story. Like the other DLO we just read, that attic, that weird attic space that had the resin in the keyhole to maybe keep something in or out or not have a key go into it again.
Yeah.
So, skeleton keys, always a great trope in any story.
At my great-grandparents' house, I remember that there were keys all over that house. I think I still have some somewhere that were skeleton keys. Yeah, I mean, there's the sort of generic, mundane stuff here. If we brought, we brought our skeptics in to take a look at this, you know, people are going to say, well, West Virginia has a lot of radon, which is true. Sure. Radon is elevated there. I don't know if they have radon detectors in this home, but I have mixed feelings about that. I think it definitely can be a problem, but also I think old homes are kind of drafty. So it's I don't know how effective they are at capturing radon, but it's definitely a concern. And that can cause, you know, that can cause hallucinations and stuff like that. Or
mold, in rare cases, you know, that's the other thing. Rare cases.
It's rare cases. And I think in all of our years of getting stories where people did try to check for radon, there was only one story where it seemed like it was a possibility of causing an issue. And then all the rest, like, it's no, we checked for it, there was none. So that's an interesting thing there. The person at the foot of the bed, that's a classic hypnopompic situation, like sleep paralysis, which we've talked about ad nauseum in multiple episodes of the main show, the old hag and all of that kind of thing, you know, and that's where you wake up and you see something. We have a lot of stories like that where people are seeing things that, but in some cases, the people weren't asleep. So that's the other part of that. It's hard to imagine that there's not more to that than just some chemical side effect of being a human being, because there's just so many of those stories, so many of them.
The other thing too is that, okay, so then it's radon, you know, but does that cause the same hallucination in everybody of the old
does
woman
everyone
crawling
see the same thing? No, absolutely not. Yeah. Good point.
If it is causing specifically an old lady to crawl up your bed, why is that? You know, like what is going on there with radon in the human brain? That should be studied and it's fascinating.
Yeah.
But what I'm saying is in context here of all the family members, everybody seeing stuff, even the dog.
Yeah.
It's like, well, the dog's being affected by old wiring, tricking its brain with the radon-addled dog brain.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, but altogether, is that, are there other physical medical side effects, which you would think if you're to that point where everyone's hallucinating?
Yeah.
It should be causing other physical symptoms.
Yeah.
And we don't know that for a fact, but like, yeah, I don't think that explains away everything.
No. And the other thing I think is interesting is a lot of the stuff that's going on here, I mean, it's an old home and it's an old town and all of that stuff. It's very classic sort of elements of haunting. And there's a lot of things that have common ground with our Bell Witch series, which we did episodes 85 through 88 many years ago. You know, the apparitions of children, the dog reacting, the escalating phenomena, the stuff that's going on there. There is some common ground there that's a little bit strange to me. You know, there was not a verbal back and forth communication like there was with the Bell Witch. That was a very exceptionally intense situation.
Yeah.
But, you know, Betsy Bell said she saw a girl in a green dress swinging from an oak limb on the property during that. There's other cases that had common ground here. The Enfield Poltergeist in the UK in 1977, the Smurl haunting, which I don't think we covered in Pennsylvania in the 80s. So there's just a lot of sort of revenant ideas where the deceased are coming back to play, for lack of a better word.
I liked your idea earlier that there's a confluence of a bunch of different things happening. Like I said, did the little girl die in the Civil War? I don't know. But it could be something separate that's just, you know, that house has been around so long, it's collected supernatural dust bunnies under the bed, and that now they're all kind of gathered together into this one thing that is active in this house. But yeah, Civil War influence, past residents, the little girl, the guy at the foot of the bed, there's a lot going on there.
And you know what other little girl is in a haunted house?
Oh, yes. Get your shot glass out,
Sally,
folks.
Shot glass Sally.
Well, that's there you go. Yeah, it's such a common thing. And why is that? It's the image of the little girl. And so that's the other thing over the years. Anyone who's researched this genre, this field, will say is like, yeah, there's very common things. Baby cries out in the wilderness where no one's there.
Right.
Little girls playing with a ball or in old-fashioned dresses. Young women wearing white gowns. It's such a common thing, the lady in white. Like, why are these tropes so common?
Yeah.
And like I said, people are saying like, well, that's just a activity of the human brain under certain stressful situations. And you've been front loaded to imagine this and it's just your imagination. It's like, why are those tropes so common? Can you just chalk that down to pop culture and things we see in literature? Well, I think it's a bit much for that. And that it's, you're not just getting these references. Like I said, the book, well, you just read that book as a kid and then you imagine all this stuff. It's like, did everybody in the family read the book? Are they all influencing each other? It's too much to ask of that hypothesis, I think.
Well, stories like Jonathan's are why we're here. Kid moves into a house he didn't choose and a town his family didn't pick on his behalf. And then the home pushes back against him a little. He pays attention because what choice does a child have? Decades later, he's still working through it, and he carries this story carefully, almost reverently, the way you'd carry something heavy that wasn't yours to put down. Jonathan, man, thanks so much for finally telling us. It's been great catching up this past week or two. Thanks for carrying it for that long, for showing up at Monster Fest, hoping to say it in person to us, and for trusting it to us now. There's something powerful about a house that has some rules about you being in it, because it means somewhere, someone, or something else thought it was theirs first. Thank you for sending your letter into the Astonishing Dead Letter Office.
Astonishing Dead Letter Office is hosted by Scott Philbrick and Forrest Burgess and is executive produced by Tess Feifel. The show is edited and mixed by Sarah Voorhees-Wendell at VW Sound. The theme is based on the Astonishing Legends theme by Judson Crane at Founder Music, arranged by Alan Caricia, who composes all the other music in the show. Tommy Beaver Design created the logo. The announcer is John Bolton. That's me. Stories are lightly edited for length, content, and readability, but otherwise presented as they're sent to us. We're always looking for more dead letters, so if you have a story of your own you'd like to share, email it to deadletteroffice@astonishinglegends.com. Please include how you would like to be credited. First name only, first name last initial, anonymous, a pseudonym. Let us know. Due to the number of emails coming in, we often cannot respond, but we do read them all. No part of the show may be reproduced anywhere without permission. Copyright Astonishing Legends Productions.